One of the best things that you can do for your cognitive health is exercising and really contracting your muscles. And that's where the circle comes back to, you know, the benefits of resistance training, but also even things like you're activating and contracting so many muscles around your body that you're releasing a lot of these myokines, which not only direct benefits to your brain, but if we're speaking from a mental health lens, the thought process is that can also help with some of the pathophysiology associated with depression.
Welcome to the Psychiatry Tomorrow podcast. I'm Dr. Will Sobey.
And I'm Dr. Carolyn McMillan. And in each episode, we interview thought leaders in the deep end of psychiatry's next frontier. Dive into the latest research, innovative treatments, technology, and policy developments shaping the future of psychiatry.
Join us on this journey to discover what's next in mental health care so that you can stay ahead of the curve.
That white powder bodybuilders chug in their protein shakes, it's not just for bulking up. Creatine, the go-to supplement for athletes, might be rewiring depressed brains. New studies show it can supercharge depression treatments, but how does a muscle-building compound cross over to boost mental health? Today, I'm joined by Dr. Nicholas Fabiano, a rising star in psychiatry at the University of Ottawa, who's shaking up the field with lifestyle psychiatry. He's diving into how exercise isn't just a feel-good habit. It's a legit first-line treatment for depression. In this episode, you'll learn why exercise can rival antidepressants for some patients and how to prescribe it right, how creatine's brain benefits go way beyond the gym, the role of myokines, proteins linking muscle movement to mood, when too much exercise might actually harm mental health. As someone who's worked in inpatient psychiatry and TMS, I'm fascinated by this blend of physical and mental health. Whether you're a clinician or just curious about the future of mental health, this conversation is packed with insights. Let's jump in with Dr. Nicholas Fabiano. Dr. Fabiano, I've been dying to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. For the sake of our listeners, you're a resident at the University of Ottawa in your third year, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Now, tell me, a little bit curious, what are your rotations like in third year in Canada?
Yeah, so in general, in psychiatry, so we have a five-year program. The first year is what we do kind of more off-service. We're doing a bunch of different stuff from internal medicine, emergency medicine, all over the place. After that, we're strictly psychiatry. So you're just on a bunch of different subspecialties within psychiatry. In my third year right now, we actually have very long blocks. So they are 6 months at a time. Traditionally, other residents do 1 month and switch to something else. So This year so far, I've only been on two different rotations essentially because the year has, you know, 12 months and you split that up sort of thing. So I started on child for 6 months in July. And then I recently switched over to just general adult outpatients, which I've been doing since about mid-January. So it's been a good experience. I've got to get kind of the full spectrum of age and also both from in and outpatient. So it's been really good so far.
Okay. So do you appreciate the longer blocks, like a long, kind of nice long stretch, sort of doing like one consistent continuity, like that stuff?
Yeah, no, it's nice to be at a place for a while because you can really get familiar with the environment. You can see what you like, what you don't like. You start getting more efficient at the different tasks that you're doing. So, you know, in outpatients, if there's specific orders that you have to keep in or your inbox that you have to keep an eye on, you are quicker to be efficient at that, which helps with commitments to other stuff outside of work too, like research too. You can spend more time there because you're more efficient at some of the clinical stuff. So I particularly like the 6 months, having done the 1 month before in my first year than during medical school as well. I find the continuity is nice and it really allows you to study and get the knowledge you need in that field for a prolonged period of time. So you can really reinforce it rather than doing something, switching repetitively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that every 4 weeks thing, it does get a little tiresome. All right. Well, even with all that going on, somehow you have time to build up a following on X where you're like 70,000 followers. And you've gained quite a bit of notoriety in what people might call lifestyle psychiatry. Mm-hmm. First question I had for you is, what would you call lifestyle psychiatry, right?
I would say lifestyle psychiatry is really when you think of the fundamentals of what you do on a day-to-day basis, even if you remove the word psychiatry. So what it really focuses around is, you know, exercise, diet, and sleep habits. And it's, of course, broader than that. But lifestyle psychiatry looks at both the preventative measures for mental health, so how these may prevent the onset of a mental disorder. However, it also looks at how these factors may be used to optimize treatment. And when I say treatment, it can be used either with other therapies, so whether that's medications or actual therapy, or sometimes some of these interventions have evidence to be used alone as a monotherapy and are even recommended in guidelines for first-line treatment. So it really is a broad term for kind of these lifestyle factors that we can use to treat, but both prevent mental disorders. But it extends beyond that. I also have quite an interest in the overlap between mental and physical health. And I think lifestyle psychiatry is a perfect example of how some of these interventions would more traditionally be seen as a physical improvement, but we actually see major improvements to someone's mental health as well too.
Right. Well, and I mean, how can you possibly have a healthy brain if the rest of you is not healthy?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great point. And I think that's where we draw this arbitrary divide between mental and physical health. I don't think that it's super helpful because it makes us think that we're having these interventions or different things for specific tasks, whether it's your mind or body. But in reality, almost everything affects both.
Right. Yeah. Well said. Which, nice segue, because you've done a lot of work exploring exercise, you know, as a treatment for mild to moderate depression, I think is like what the internet would tell us. So can you walk us through that a little bit? Like your work so far in that area?
Yeah. So far the field of exercise for depression specifically has been growing rapidly over the last little bit. If you were to look at the field 20 years ago, for instance, and say, I wanted to treat depression with exercise, people would say, you're crazy. Like, that's not going to work. But over the years, there's been thousands of publications coming out now. And what we've done so far is we've been able to bring some of that evidence together in some of our own meta-analyses. But in some of the bigger meta-analyses that were not even done by myself or my group, and when I use the word meta-analyses, that means just bringing studies together in one to summarize that evidence. It's shown that when we look at the randomized control trial data, exercise for the treatment of mild to moderate depression, as you mentioned, can be equally as effective as medications or therapy. Again, big caveat being that these are RCT data. This is not necessarily real world. So adherence may be better when you have someone watching you exercise and all these different supports. However, I think it's still quite a promising thing to see, specifically because in psychiatry, we don't have a lot of options in terms of when someone comes to you saying, I'm depressed. The quick reaction for most people is, here's your antidepressant, or here's therapy, which may be too expensive for you to do. It's nice to have other options as well, too. So that's kind of where the evidence base has kind of grown so far.
Well, yeah, not just here's your antidepressant, but here's your sixth antidepressant, right? I mean, we all know how that's been going. You may have kind of accidentally dimed me out for how old I am, because 20 years ago was when I was in residency. And yes, like people said, you know, there was a paper I remember back then. It was kind of a big blow up that exercise seemed to be just as good in depression as maybe SSRIs. Back then, our attending suggested to us that the kind of people who will spontaneously get over depression are also the kind of people who exercise. Right? Like that might have been kind of the obvious point to make back then. You know, clearly with, you know, something that's a little more randomized controlled trial, right? You can do better than that. Though I'm kind of interested in what constitutes the placebo exercise.
Yeah, so that's a great point. In exercise research, and this extends to other research, like even psychedelic research, where there's quite a difficulty in both the control, but effective blinding. Because you can have an RCT design and you can say it's a double blind trial because that's what you do. But you can't really blind someone to exercising. Even if you quite literally put a blindfold on them, they're going to know they're exercising. So there is a difficulty, and different trials have different ways of doing it. Some of them have someone in an exercise group say they're running and the control group is no movement at all. So that's just a full control, no intervention. Some of them take more of an active role. So maybe it's active stretching groups, but not necessarily a higher intensity running or weightlifting group. So there's some controls that, and they try to find this medium. And then some other studies use higher intensity exercise and very low intensity exercises, and low being the control group. So there's a lot of different ways that people try to tackle the control situation, but albeit none of them are perfect. And the same issue is pervasive, as I mentioned, in psychedelic trials and stuff like this, where when you're administering that intervention, there is an effect or there is something that the participant is able to say, I know what group I'm randomized to, which has inherent bias to it, which is important to when you are interpreting the results. But I don't think that it fully takes away from some of the results that we're seeing. It's just important in those discussions to be aware of too, for the nuances.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that there's similar challenges in the world of TMS, right? Like how do you sham TMS treatment when people can feel that stimulation on their scalp? And right, I think the sham TMS coils that are used now, it's not much different than a joy buzzer to the head. Right? So that, you know, that is very difficult to do. Someone ended up actually with the joy buzzer to the head. Someone ended up doing a trial that those people got better. So it's like, you know, maybe tapping on someone's head isn't actually a sham, right? So that makes it difficult too. With all of that, do you think that you've zeroed in on any particular form of exercise that rises above the others? Like, is it any exercise helps, or do we need to do something specific?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question, because lots of people ask me, what is the best exercise or optimal exercise from a depression standpoint? And looking across studies and the meta-analyses, there's no clear answer in terms of what exercise is best. So to break it down, we broadly look at exercise types as aerobic, which is something like running, resistance, which is something like weight training, or mind-body, which is something like yoga. And among those, breaking those up into the different groups, when we compare them in meta-analyses, there's not really a huge difference between the groups. What we have found, though, is that the intensity of exercise is really what is proportional to the antidepressant effect. So the higher the intensity, the greater the antidepressant effect. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot of nuances to that too. You can't apply that to every patient population. So an example would be in elderly populations, usually a moderate or low intensity is better than a high intensity. And that's probably a testament to maybe physical capabilities. And if you're forcing someone to do this high intensity exercise, it's probably not going to be pleasurable or beneficial for someone's mental health. So there's nuances to that statement, but that's kind of the general trend of what we see. And we see the most important part is this. And the same thing goes for diet, is if you're going to do something, you want to be able to adhere to it. So making sure that it's something the patient actually wants to do. Oftentimes doctors throw stuff in your face saying, oh, go for a run, go for this. Maybe they don't want to do that. So right. If there's something that the patient already has in their mind, like, I just want to go for a walk around the block for 30 minutes every day, that's going to do a whole lot better than this AI-generated optimal protocol for exercise from a depression standpoint, because the person's actually going to do the one that they want to do. And from there, you can really build up. And then the other thing is too, when you look at someone going from completely sedentary and not moving to even just starting to exercise a bit, and that can be just going up to the stairs to your apartment if you're not too high up. That little bout of exercise has such a significant antidepressant effect from going from not moving at all to just a little bit.
Yeah.
That you can use that as momentum to keep going. So those are some of the general factors.
I was wondering if that's where you're headed, because in the gym, we call that newbie gains, right? Like that you go to lifting weights for the first time and people make these huge gains in like 6 weeks and they're super excited. And then after that, they're super bummed because it takes like 6 years to do that again, right? That somebody achieved in 6 weeks, which then leads me to a tiny aside. What do you like to do?
Personally, I started off doing soccer early on, and I got into weights actually when I got into medical school, because I found it was something that I could do on my own time, whereas mm-hmm. soccer required, you know, practice. You have to go to a game at a specific time. And as you get older and you're not playing at a higher level, these games are at like 11 p.m., 10 p.m. And I like my sleep. So I've been into more of the resistance training. I've been doing that since the start of medical school to now. I've ran here and there. I'll be honest. I'm not a big fan of the running as much as the weight training. It's just something I enjoy a lot more with the weights, kind of putting some music on, going to the gym for an hour or so, whether it's before or after work, and just using that time to just either not think about anything, or I have the opposite where a lot of my ideas actually come about during an exercise session because I'm not worried about real life per se. I'm just allowing my mind to wander while lifting heavy weights. So that's what I've found most helpful for myself.
Well, that I sympathize with you about the running. Many, many times I've said I lift weights so that I will not be called upon to run.
Like that's, yeah, there you go.
That's kind of precisely the point there. So yeah, I'm with you. When it comes to lifting weights, I was particularly struck by something you posted very recently about the muscle cells and culture and the wonderful, wonderful scientists built those tiny, tiny little actuators so that they could, you know, you could stretch the muscles and that, you know, especially talking to another weightlifter, there's something special about the muscle being stretched under load, right? That was what I got out of that. And that the myokines and that, and I take it, and you might even be willing to elaborate a little bit, that that's a big part maybe of the, if I, again, remember correctly, we had a lot about BDNF, right? We had a lot about neurotrophic factors when those myokines are released. And then, of course, all the cool kids are always talking about inflammation, right? So anything that ends with kine, you know, that brings that up.
Mm. Yeah, so to that point, myokines are a new way to essentially perceive the muscle. So before, skeletal muscle was just perceived as muscle. It did its thing. It contracted, it lifted heavy things.
Right.
However, more recently, we're seeing that the muscle acts more like an endocrine organ. And by secreting these myokines, so there's a variety of different myokines that do a lot of different things, but the general trend in the paper that you're referring to, that paper actually looked at, they grew artificial muscle from, I believe it was mice.
Yeah, it sounds right.
They had an interesting setup where they were able to genetically engineer it to, when they flashed a light on it, it contracted. Mm-hmm. So they essentially simulated exercise by flashing a light over and over, which contracted that muscle over and over. And what that did was release these myokines. And what they found was in the presence, when there was neurons in the presence of this myokine, they grew four times further than those that were not. And interestingly too, they took it even further. They actually stretched these neurons as well on their own, just kind of pulling them out. And they found that that actually caused them to grow more too. And I can't speak to the latter part of that, but I can speak more to the myokine aspect and where it applies to humans as well too, is we know that the body releases some of these myokines, which facilitates communication with other organs, but also where we're most excited about is the brain, right? And that's what we think has some of these antidepressant effects. So to dial it back, we don't actually know what causes depression per se, but we can say that some of these myokines, they help the muscles communicate with the brain. But one of the ones that you hear about the most is BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Right.
And people describe that to be the miracle grow for the brain. So it's one of the best things that you can do for your cognitive health is exercising and really contracting your muscles. And that's where the circle comes back to, you know, the benefits of resistance training, but also even things like cardio. When you're running over and over and over, you're activating and contracting so many muscles around your body that you're releasing a lot of these myokines, which, you know, not only direct benefits to your brain, but if we're speaking from a mental health lens, the thought process is that can also help with some of the pathophysiology associated with depression. And there's also structural changes to the brain that happens as a result of this. We know that exercise can actually increase the size of your hippocampus, mm-hmm. Which is important for memory and things like that. And you touched upon too. So in depression, inflammation is a big thing too. And we know that exercise, although it can cause sometimes local inflammation of the muscles and stuff, overall, it can actually decrease some of the inflammation in your body and also help your heart rate and all these different vital sign abnormalities that may be present and be associated with a depression, restore back to kind of baseline or improve from that side. So beyond myokines, we see benefits there to your metabolic health in terms of weight, blood pressure, et cetera. And it really links it all nicely together to say that, hey, when I contract my muscle, this has this effect and potentially is actually helping from a cognitive and depressive standpoint.
Yeah. And of course, your body knows better than to outgrow its resources. So your brain's not going to grow if it doesn't have adequate fuel, which is why I'm also so excited with what you've had to say about creatine. And I've already had my 20 grams today. So we're good.
Yeah.
And that, and like you, I've been using it for many years, right? So I was excited, you know, to tell everybody on social media when I started reading these papers that I also started using creatine in medical school. You know, this would have been back in the 90s, but, and I just wanted to do it so that I could lift heavier weights and row harder. You know, that the only thought I had, it never really occurred to me that it was also, you know, helping my brain.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. And here we are now. And it's an interesting area because like you mentioned, creatine's been around. It's not this novel thing per se.
Probably best studied, right? Athletic supplement there is. I mean, I think that's a conventional wisdom, correct?
Yeah. No. I think it's one of the things that from a risk benefit ratio, and that's why it's so favorable. First, in the fitness world, when you look at it, there's not a lot of harms that are associated with it, which is why you saw rapid uptake. And with it, the first thing is that people started taking it more from that fitness perspective. They said, you know, the research is showing if I take this, I'll get more reps, I'll recover better, I'll be able to grow my muscles more. Even in endurance exercise, like running, people take creatine because it helps you essentially replenish your energy stores faster.
Right.
You can go further. So that's where we first saw creatine really gain popularity, but it's been a bridge to mental health. And not even recently, there were studies earlier on in the, I think 2011 sort of thing, where we saw creatine paired with antidepressants. But I think where the signal first came from was the cognitive benefits of creatine. People started noticing that perhaps there's a cognitive side to this as well too. Mm-hmm. And then historically too, I'm actually not sure of when the first trial was, but what they started to do was they're saying, you know, let's pair this with an antidepressant and see what happens. And in a trial by, I believe it was Liu et al. In 2011, in the American Journal of Psychiatry, they paired it with an antidepressant over 8 weeks. And 2 weeks in, they already noticed an improved response. And then at 8 weeks, the response continued to improve. So that was the first signal to say, maybe this is beneficial from a depression standpoint. And since then, there's been a few other trials in depression, mostly combining to the antidepressants as an augmentation. But one that was pretty exciting recently was just published this year, actually, in European Neuropsychopharmacology, I believe by Sherpa et al. They paired creatine with cognitive behavioral therapy, which is first-line treatment for depression. Mm-hmm. And they found, again, a similar trend where they had improved response at the end of 8 weeks. And it was very well tolerated. There weren't these significant side effects. So again, although this is just a very preliminary trial for the creatine world pairing it with therapy, I think it makes sense. We can go down the whole bioenergetic lens, but I think even from a pure cognitive standpoint, I think that would even allow you engage more in therapy. If you're more cognitively kind of alert and you're able to just be more present, perhaps that could be a mechanism for its benefits in therapy. And then there's the whole bioenergetics that I'm sure we'll get into later, but it's just quite an interesting compound. And I'm glad that it's found its way into mental health because I think, again, risk benefit, very favorable. It's very cheap. It's very accessible. And I think it's something that could benefit a lot of people.
Staying ahead of research, running a practice, networking, and treating patients, who has time for it all? That's why Osmind created the Psychiatry Collective, the premier community for interventional psychiatrists. Join thousands of forward-thinking mental health clinicians staying ahead of the curve with resources, burning case questions, live events, and exclusive spaces for TMS, Spravato, and Ketamine. Just go to osmind.org/community to claim your spot. Yeah, 100%. And that, I mean, what I can right now, I think I can get a jar of about 90 servings for about $35. Right. So something that is like kind of utterly benign as something you put in your mouth could ever be. And so cheap, it's practically free, ubiquitous, easy to find. You know, even if the benefit was small, the risk is so low, you know, the ratio goes close to infinity, right? But you hit the nail right on the head. A big part of my background is inpatient psychiatry, you know, so not just treating people with depression, but severe depression for the vast majority of my career. And cognitive impairment is probably the most common feature of that. And I've remarked many, many times, I'm classically trained. I'm a huge believer in psychotherapy. And to try to make a cognitively impaired person do psychotherapy, in my opinion, is almost cruel. Like that, like not only does better cognition lead to better outcomes, it's it's kind of painful for someone who is having such a hard time cognitively. So yeah, I'm 100% interested in that. But bioenergetic wise, you know, that my background is inpatient, but my background is also TMS. So when I'm stimulating a brain, you know, that the classic currently, you know, traditional FDA approved version of TMS is 3,000 electrical pulses to the brain in about 20 minutes. I'm not sure that people really respect how much work that is. Right? That's a lot of hard, we're putting your brain on a treadmill. That's a lot of hard work. That's a lot of fuel. And so it's been extremely interesting to me the way that something like creatine might push, you know, creatine helps me, you know, lift the barbell more times because I can replenish that ATP, you know, quickly in between sets. It's a little embarrassing to me that it never occurred to me that it's probably the same thing in the brain, that we can, you know, we can put that ATP back to where it needs to be very, very quickly instead of having to wait, you know, for all the regular metabolic processes to take place.
No, it's a great point you make. And then to build on that too, I think the view for so long was with creatine, there was such a focus on the muscle, which makes sense because when we talk about supplementing creatine, 95% or approximately of it goes to your muscle and right. It's stored as phosphocreatine. The remainder, some of it's distributed to other organs, but we'll say about 5% goes to the brain sort of thing. And there's not as much uptake because there's not as many receptors and transporters that are as expressed in brain tissue as there is in muscle. But nonetheless, there is an argument to say that, you know, creatine likely has those benefits as well too by being transported to the brain. The question becomes though, the dosing that we speak about from a fitness perspective is commonly this 5 grams per day. That's what you'll hear kind of across the board.
Right.
And sometimes that's preceded by like a loading phase where someone takes 20 grams a day, split into 4 doses for a week or so, to saturate stuff more rapidly. But in the trials that I actually discussed, most of them pair creatine with whatever treatment at 5 grams per day or lower. And I think it's because there's this fear of doing something that's abnormal or may put someone at harm at a higher dose. But there's literature that's coming out to show that perhaps we need a higher dose than 5. And it's looking like around 10 or even higher to really see brain benefits, mental health benefits. And there's not a clear answer for that right now. But again, to leverage on that safety profile, we know it's a relatively safe substance. Again, not as a blanket for everyone's statement, but in general, that it's going to be exciting to see more studies that use higher doses and for longer periods of time, because although the muscle can saturate in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks sort of thing, likely the brain takes a lot longer because, again, the lack of those transporters, the higher doses needed, the less that's actually going to the brain. So I think we'll actually see better results as these trials last longer, as these trials are at higher doses and paired with other modalities. And that's a whole other concept. You spoke about the concept of, you know, from cognition to engage in therapy. One thing that makes the most sense to pair is creatine plus exercise, which we actually wrote a paper about recently, was, you know, we have all these studies pairing it with antidepressants and therapy. And we know that antidepressants and therapy are pretty similar in antidepressant effect in mild to moderate depression. So why wouldn't we pair exercise and creatine when it's already being done? If you went to your gym and you ask some of these people, they're already doing it. So I think that's where there's a big gap in the literature is let's pair creatine at the doses and duration that I mentioned before with exercise and see what effect does that have on depression. And I think that will be very telling to see kind of what is creatine really doing and what potential does it have.
Yeah, I agree. That could be really telling. Which I mean, that halfway answers, but leads to my next question is how do you think a psychiatrist, you know, in clinic right now would integrate any of this in terms of exercise, creatine supplementation, you know, into their treatment plans for their patients?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, a few things. I think to speak to 2 points separately, let's talk about exercise first. Mm-hmm. To implement this into your clinic, it's something that you need to have a certain degree of comfortability to talk about first. So we know based on research, people that exercise as their own hobby or for whatever reason, they're more likely to speak to their patient about it, which makes sense. But if you don't have that experience, I still think as a physician, it is, you know, somewhat of your duty to at least be able to speak to your patient about some of these interventions because it is a viable treatment option. So having some, you know, education around that, learning about it is very important. And a framework that psychiatrists or family doctors or primary care doctors can use is something called the FIT framework. And it's similar to how you would prescribe a medication. So a medication, you would prescribe what the medication is, you would prescribe the dose of the medication, you would prescribe how often you're taking it, all these different variables. For exercise, you can do the same thing. You can use the FIT framework, which stands for frequency, intensity, type, and time.
Okay.
So you break up those variables and you can very straightforward talk to your patient about it. So frequency is how many times you're going to exercise per week. And again, the goal is start low and go slow. And it's the same thing for medications. It's the same saying for stuff that we... So these principles are applicable. And then same thing. So the I, intensity, you break that up into low, moderate, or vigorous. And again, start low, build up from there sort of thing. T is the timing. So how long are these sessions going to be? Are they going to be 10 minutes to start? Are they going to be an hour? What works for them? And then the last T is the type of exercise. And that's what I spoke about before. Is it running, like aerobic? Is it weightlifting, like a resistance training? Or is it a mind-body like yoga? And you can very realistically have a conversation with your patient about that. Write down the FIT framework as you would for a prescription. And each time you see your patient, the goal is to maybe go up a little bit. Or when you find that dose that works, akin to a medication, you stay there, right? So it's the same principle that you could do for a medication, applying it to exercise. It's just needing to actively be there more for your patient than to say, go exercise. Because I'm sure many people have had that experience where you go to your doctor, whether it's for mental health or any other reason, and you're told you should just go for a run or you should do XYZ. It's not very actionable.
Right.
So I think having something to really speak to your patient and follow up with is important, because you can put that in the chart. You can say, we said we're going to do this frequency, this intensity, this type, and then follow up thereafter and see how it's working or how it's not.
I like that. I mean, that's the mistake that people make in their New Year's resolutions, right? Like you say, I'm going to eat better. but then, well, what does that mean? Right? No one was ever going to achieve that, because that's not a goal. Because you would say, better than what? You know, what, how much, you know, of what? And the same thing applies to exercise. So the FIT framework, is that something our listeners can just find on the internet?
Yeah, so we actually have a paper that we had written about it. It's called How to Prescribe Physical Activity for Depression. It's in the journal Sports Psychiatry. So we break down that framework and kind of discuss how to prescribe it and stuff like that. It's a pretty short read, probably just over 1,000 words sort of thing, but it's a useful clinical tool. It's not super research heavy. It's more of a meant for psychiatrists or primary care doctors to kind of use to help prescribe exercise if someone's interested in talking about it.
Outstanding. It's I've kind of dreamed of a clinic that actually had a training studio in it. It's like, I mean, I love this idea of the FIT framework. I'm going to look it up immediately when we finish this conversation. But then I also worry a little bit, you know, I've had patients, I'm not so sure if they can lift weights safely, right? Like that, I think that needs to be a consideration as well. I don't know if we have a plan yet, or we have to dream one up as to how to deal with that. But I mean, that's why I've also imagined, like, maybe I either need to hire a trainer or take on the role of trainer myself as a physician, to not just tell my patients what to do, but to teach them what to do.
Yep. No, it's a great point you make. And I think to that point, you know, one of the solutions could be having a trainer, but that may not be feasible. That can be expensive. That can be time consuming and stuff. So that's where I think there's a gap, at least speaking from my experience in terms of what resources we have available to us. I think it would be amazing if we could have someone where we could prescribe a prescription to a patient to say, hey, here's a gym trainer for 1 week to get into stuff, or 2 weeks, or whatever that is, because we know that supervised exercise interventions do better than non-supervised from an antidepressant perspective because of the adherence side of things. So it's definitely a gap in our current treatment right now, because it would be great to be on the FIT, to be able to prescribe a fitness trainer, to prescribe a gym membership even, because maybe that's not something that is financially feasible for the person in front of you too. There's a lot of barriers that people think, oh, exercise is just, you know, go move your body sort of thing. But if that person really wants to go to the gym and it's expensive and they're already not able to afford food and rent and stuff like that, you're presenting an option to someone who, you know, won't be able to do it. And that can discourage them more. So, and even outside of depression, looking at other of the severe mental illness like schizophrenia, prescribing exercise in that fashion may not be effective, particularly in the early stages of disease if someone's still having residual psychotic symptoms and stuff of that sort. And we actually wrote a paper to the Lancet Psychiatry recently that was just accepted for international guidelines were published called Integrate for the Management of Schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And generally, they recommended lifestyle interventions at all stages, but it was more of that passive recommendation. So our letter, which it should be coming out in the next few weeks sort of thing, mentioned that, you know, in these instances, it's important that beyond just passively recommending, you have something in place to actually have supervision or to allow the patient to follow through with it. And the same principle can be applied for depression. And particularly as the severity of depression increases, the adherence probably will go down unless we have measures to kind of make sure that people are able to follow through and have a successful go at the exercise.
Absolutely. Which kind of the other side of that coin, I think you've written also about maybe too much exercise, or that, you know, exercise can even start turning into a little bit of a self-harm, right? If we're not careful. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So anything, too much of anything can be a bad thing. Exercise is included in that umbrella too. And oftentimes in psychiatry, we talk about too much exercise to be a bad thing only in eating disorders. So we talk about the people that maybe have an anorexia or bulimia that are exercising in excess in response to caloric intake or body image issues, which is true. That is happening. But I think there's a subpopulation that we aren't seeing that is using exercise that may have depression, but not from the sake of using it to help alleviate their depression. And to kind of paint the clinical scenario, you can imagine someone that has depression or had something really bad happen in their life. And to cope, they're going to the gym now. They're going super hard or they're running really far, but they're going with the intention to feel pain. They're going with the intention to injure themselves. They're going with the intention to transfer that emotional pain into something physical, which is something that we see in self-harm in the more traditionally defined ones where we talk about cutting or burning and stuff of that sort. And the problem with exercise is we often see it as this always good thing. If you went to your doctor and said, hey, I've been depressed. I went through a breakup. I'm really sad. I've been in the gym 6 hours a day. Your doctor would be like, that's great. That's sublimation. You're doing a great thing.
Right.
So it's reinforced, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, this person maybe isn't getting the benefits from exercise and it's perpetuating the cycle. They're going to everyone seeking help saying, hey, I'm doing this. And it's not getting better because exercise doesn't cure everyone's depression. And sometimes if you're doing it for the wrong reasons or with the intent of harming yourself, it can be a bad thing that is continually reinforced without addressing the actual depression. And in that stance, it's important that we recognize that perhaps there is a subpopulation of these people that are engaging in exercise for more of that self-harm rather than enjoying it and gaining the antidepressant effects of it. And opening that discussion because it can be helpful for the patient in front of you who may not even realize it themselves. So that was a piece that I had written, not based on data, but based on just kind of a perspective that I had had. And to not be too long-winded on that was we had done two previous meta-analyses on that topic of exercise and suicide. Across both of them, we found that exercise reduced suicide attempts, but not deaths or not ideation. So thoughts of suicide. The latter was probably, or the deaths was probably due to lack of statistical power. Thankfully, there's not many events of that happen. But the thought was that at the time, exercise probably reduced emotional impulsivity. But I thought about it a year later and thought, what is an alternative explanation? And that's where the idea for this exercise of self-harm came in, being perhaps the exercise is replacing the suicide attempts rather than reducing it in the form of self-harm. And again, more of a theoretical piece, but I think it's an important thing to just be aware of and maybe open the discussion with your patient because it's a quick conversation. And maybe helpful for them as well too.
Yeah. I mean, what would you say are top one or two maybe red flags that might inspire that conversation when you're in the clinic for that brief med check?
I would say if it seems like on the outward, there is an excessive amount that's occurring. So someone's telling you, hey, I'm going to the gym three times a day. I'm exercising for 6 hours. You know, some people may be like, that's great, but that should set off some red flags if there seems to be some sort of a dependency on it.
Right.
The other thing from a physician's perspective, whether it's psychiatrist, primary care doctor, if you're noticing this person is experiencing a lot more injuries recently, so whether that is minor things like more bruises or strained shoulders and stuff like that, it could be not related, but it could be a representation of someone going beyond what they are physically able to in an attempt to harm themselves, whether they know or not. So I think those would probably be the top two that would stand out in terms of amount of time. And then also if there's any observable kind of injuries from that front.
It's interesting you should say that, because I feel like something, again, like 20 years ago when I was training, you know, we used words like pathological fracture and, you know, overuse injury. Like that, I got the impression that as physicians, we knew that there were certain injuries that shouldn't happen. Like, so if you saw that injury in clinic, you wouldn't think it was an accident, and you would start asking things like, you know, how much is someone training? Are they overtraining so much that we're starting to see weakening of tissue? Or is there something going on with someone's nutritional status so that a bone that shouldn't really break just standing on the sidewalk did? Things like that. And I fear that I don't hear that conversation recently, and that maybe it is time for physicians to get a little bit back to understanding that physiology, that, you know, the injuries like that we shouldn't be seeing. And yeah, that's a good reason to ask that question about the training and the nutrition and basically someone's physical health status, to kind of go all the way back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very quick question, and it can open a whole different perspective for both yourself as the provider and the patient. So I think it's worthwhile to at least ask, rather than, again, automatically assuming that all exercise is good. And I think it's a good principle for anything that applies to diet too, that applies to any of the things that lifestyle wise can be overdone and can be harmful. So I think it's important to also check that from that perspective and just see how they're doing and ask the question.
All right. Well, in a couple minutes that we might have left, I feel like every time I turn around, I see something new that you've written. So I am curious about how you're fitting it all in with these extra long third year rotations and getting it all done.
Yeah. My biggest advice is I still prioritize a lot of the lifestyle stuff. I think sometimes what people tend to do when they get busy is they let other things kind of slip, and something you're not in control of, like sleep and being on call and different things like that. But the biggest benefit to me has been maintaining my exercise routine, maintaining a healthy diet, trying to sleep as much as I, not as much as I can, but optimize.
Well, as much as you can. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
And I think I realized that early on in medical school, because when I first started, it was, you know, a big course load. You have a lot to study, a whole lot to learn. And I let some of those things slip early on. Mm-hmm. And I got into the cycle where I was just studying all the time. And I felt like I was just falling behind perpetually. And then I thought, like, how about I take care of myself? I actually go to the gym. I do these things that matter. And I was studying less, and I found I was doing better. So I think that's the principle I've extended to residency and everything now, is making sure you take care of yourself, your own cognitive health, because that will full circle go back to your own efficiency and being able to get stuff done. Otherwise, you get stuck in the cycle of, oh, I just need to get this next task done in residency. I need to get this next paper written, and it never ends. So making time for yourself actually makes time for efficiency and getting things done. And that's kind of where my passion as well for some of the lifestyle stuff comes from, is making people realize that too. And again, it's not always possible. Sometimes life circumstances don't allow for some stuff, but making sure you keep that as a priority if possible.
Physician, heal thyself.
Yes.
All right. So last question. If you had to pick one thing in our field of psychiatry that you think is really going to transform patient care in the next decade, in other words, what's going to be ground zero for you, right? What do you think that one thing would be?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
I would say this might be a broad and non-focused answer.
Wonderful.
But I would say, over time, removing the divide between mental and physical health that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's one particular intervention. That's not one particular way of thought. I think it's going to take time to really see that. And it's not just psychiatry. That's going to be other physicians to be on board with this too, because right now we operate in these silos in psychiatry and in whatever specialty you're in, cardiology, endocrinology, and you deal with whatever your specialty is and whatever your issue is for that patient. You don't deal with the whole patient oftentimes. And I think that's where we fall short in our treatment for these patients. I think in the future, when we're able to work together more efficiently, but also as independent practitioners, be comfortable with managing some of the other specialist stuff, we'll see better outcomes for our patient. Because to give an example, in endocrinology or something, if you're prescribing a medication, that can have effects to someone's mental health. And in mental health, a lot of our medications have really bad effects to people's metabolic health. And if we're more cognizant of that and we're more comfortable managing each other's quote-unquote specialties, there'll be better outcomes for the patient and we'll see more collaboration between discipline, more discoveries from that end, and we'll see overall more progress. And a simple example is this. Oftentimes people with schizophrenia, you start them on an antipsychotic. We know that they have a lot of metabolic burden. A simple thing to do is, you know, again, we've spoken about lifestyle this whole time. That's an option. There's other things like medications like metformin or Ozempic that can be paired with these proactively, knowing that it's going to cause someone a lot of weight gain or their insulin resistance to go way up. That can increase adherence. That can even, some argue, be the root cause of mental illness from the metabolism side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is really where the future lies, is in removing the divide that we've drawn between mental and physical health to benefit the patient, but also foster collaboration among disciplines rather than operating in these silos where we're recycling our own knowledge rather than sharing with one another.
Well said. That was a wonderful, utterly disprovable answer, right? Well, thanks so much for your time today, man.
No, thank you for having me.
I know you're super busy. It's been really great talking to you. And well, can't wait to get this out there.
Thank you for having me again.
All right.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the future.
And in the meantime, let's continue the conversation online in the Psychiatry Collective, the fastest growing interventional psychiatry community out there. Go to ozmind.org/community to join in.